Good afternoon, everybody. Maybe I should say good morning or good evening. We have a global audience. My name is Erik Bergloff. I'm the director of the Institute of Global Affairs here at the LSE School of Public Policy. We're absolutely delighted to be hosting this panel together with the Stockholm Institute of Transition Economics. It's part of a series that we are doing on COVID, but we're also doing this part of a project called the Stockholm School of governance. If the idea is to build an environment with many universities collaborating on teaching and research on complex coordination problems that are associated with the transformation to sustainable economy globally. And of course, there's probably no better illustration of what it takes. We're looking at the COVID-19 pandemic. And of course, we see all the lack of preparedness and all the fragilities in many societies. The Swedish experience from fighting COVID-19 is obviously of interest to Sweden. But as we can tell from the number of Swedes who have signed up to this webinar, it's clear. But the interest in the Swedish exception goes much beyond that. Again, the sign up for this seminar shows this. The discussion in Sweden has become very heated. But the Swedish exception is also being bandied around in many countries in support of domestic policies or to show what happens if you follow another set of policies than those recommended by that particular government. So we wanted to have this debate now, not because we know for sure what the outcome of the Swedish experiment will be. It is too early to say that, but we wanted to understand the arguments for the Swedish policy, what the strategy was, how it was played out, how it has played out so far. We also want to understand why did Sweden and no other country or very few other countries choose this model. I don't think I would like to exaggerate the difference between Sweden and other countries. In the end, it's mostly a matter of degree and of timing. And how does it compare to the historical experience in Sweden? And how does it compare to Sweden's approach to other challenges? All those issues we wanted to come to today. The most interesting comparisons are probably with other Nordic countries with similar social and political models. But it's also interesting to ask, to what extent is the Swedish experience relevant from countries, for example, where stricter lockdown policies are more difficult to adopt or even impossible to adopt. We are meeting now in a time when the epicenter of the epidemic has traveled from China via Europe to the United States. And of course, it's now going to also take hold in the emerging and developing world. It's very clear that these are sort of two intertwined crises that we will have to deal with. And we want to look at what can we learn from the Swedish experience. Where is it relevant? Where is it not relevant? We have a fantastic group of speakers, and I will introduce them one after the other as they speak. But the first, I wanted to have a chance for someone who's been relatively close to the Swedish experience and the Swedish planning and implementation of the Swedish model. And that is Tom Britton, who is a professor of epidemiology at Stockholm University. And he has been part of the team working on trying to produce the models that are being used as a basis for the Swedish experiment. So, Tom, can I let you go first?
Yeah. Okay. So this is me. I'm a professor at Stockholm University. My background is mathematics and statistics. So for those who don't know much about Sweden, it's a country of about 10 million people. So far, we have slightly less than 2,000 case fatalities. Right now, the number of case fatalities is not increasing, but rather stable. I would say that it varies between 70 and 80. And this statistics include people dying in elderly homes. There has been a discussion, at least in Sweden, that some countries have only people dying in hospitals, whereas other countries have people dying in elderly homes. And the Swedish statistics include the latter. And also the situation at intensive care unit is quite stable nowadays, still very high numbers for us, but not increasing for the moment as it seems. So I think that we have about 50 to 60 new admissions per day. Of course, they are there for a longer period of time. So I think that the current number is around 400 people in all of Sweden staying in intensive care units. I have heard, although I'm not an expert, that a surprisingly big fraction survive, so actually leave the hospital later on. 80% was something I heard in the news. So these were what I said now was sort of facts, let's say. And then there are some estimates, which there is quite a lot of uncertainty around. Well, one thing that is for sure is that the transmission is dominated in Stockholm. So that's where we have most of the cases. Some estimates of how many that have been infected up to now vary in the range between 20 and 25%. Maybe even slightly higher. I wrote a very rough report a week ago saying that it might be even more than 30%, but now there are better reports suggesting that it is rather 25% or even slightly lower. There is, of course, quite a lot of uncertainty in these estimates. For the whole country, it's even more uncertain. I'm just guessing now, but it could lie around 10% that have been infected nationwide. And what is our policy for it? I think most of our intervention started around mid-March. There are a few regulations, but I would say that most things are not regulations, but rather strong recommendations. The regulations are a few, and they are that high schools and universities are closed. Gatherings with more than 50 people are no longer allowed. And restaurants have some restrictions that you cannot stand up in restaurants, and the table have to be distant apart. I don't know the exact distance, but they have to make it fewer. That's not a problem, though, because at least indoor, very few people go to restaurants these days. Yeah. Outdoor, more people go, I would say. Even a month ago when it was very cold, you could see people sitting outside. And now the weather is getting nice, finally in Sweden, and then it's quite crowded on the outdoor seating restaurants. How about the recommendations? The strongest one is for the 70 plus people. They are strongly encouraged to self-isolate and only go out for walks, not go into any shop whatsoever. Some do, but I think most people obey this. Another recommendation is that if you have any type of symptoms, you should not go to work, and you should recover and stay 2 days additionally at home. Another recommendation is that everyone who has the possibility should work from home. Another one is to avoid public transport, in particular during rush hour, although there are no rush hours nowadays. And the final one, which was given a bit later, I would say, is that people should social distance themselves. Finally, what do I think about this policy? I think that in the beginning, the Swedish Public Health Agency did not take this serious enough. They said it will probably not strike us, but eventually they have realized it will. And another thing is that I think there is not enough testing. Now they are starting to test on higher scale, in particular for healthcare workers and people working in the elderly homes. I think the policy has been consistent all through, and I would summarize it as follows, that it is to reduce spreading, protect the elderly and other risk groups, and keep the society functioning. And maybe as Eric, or as I saw in an announcement here, is that trust the citizens that they will follow our recommendations. And it has been debated earlier if we should have a lockdown, but my feeling is that now most people support the current policy. That was my little presentation.
Yeah, thank you very much. I should have said that, of course, everyone on this panel today has some Scandinavian connection. And so we are, I guess, three Swedes and a Norwegian and a Dane. And Peter is of Danish extraction, though he's American and has, but he's married to Swedes. So it's a truly Scandinavian conspiracy today. But it's also a chance to maybe compare the different experiences across the Nordic countries. The next speaker is Lars Tregård, who is a historian and worked a lot on understanding the Swedish model, both from a historical and a comparative perspective. So, and you have been, of course, quite vocal in this debate around this Swedish experience. So Lars, please, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for organizing this event. I think it's quite needed. You know, there has been today, in fact, an article in Dagens Nyheter, the leading daily in Sweden, about the relative high rate of misrepresentation in international media about what actually is going on in Sweden. So I think it's very welcome, you know, to have an event of this sort. First of all, I'd just like to reiterate something that I think both Tom and Eric were bringing up, which is that there is a sort of misconception a little bit, I think, about Sweden. Some social memes would suggest that it is just sort of one big after-ski party in Stockholm. And this is actually quite far from the truth. Sweden is much more similar to most countries when it comes to the exercise of social distancing. So that, I think, is a very important point just to bring up. We should not exaggerate the differences. So that's, you know, the first point that I want to make here. The second one regards also thinking about differences. We have had, I think, an unfortunate, very superficial discourse so far on positing lockdown, you know, versus a lax approach, you know, and that usually is the lax approach is Sweden and the lockdown is the rest of the world. And I think this is not a very, these are empty categories, essentially. So if we want to talk about Sweden, we need to talk about specifics, the concrete, you know, what is actually going on? What is it that is different? And there are two things that I want to point to here. The most important, perhaps, and there's been a certain amount of debate, but mostly just observations, really, it regards preschools and the primary schools. This is where Sweden stands out. And this is a very important matter because it highlights something that Tom was suggesting, right? That is a concern that goes beyond, you know, let's say mortality or death rates and concerns itself with the health of society, right? This is a social disease. It attacks society, not just individuals. And why are then schools so important in Sweden? I think this has to do with this sort of status of children's rights and gender equality. Closing primary schools, right, for children is a very big matter. For older children, students in university, gymnasium, and so forth, distance learning is a realistic option. That's not really the case for preschoolers or those in primary schools. And that means that from an egalitarian children's rights perspective, keeping schools open is absolutely essential. I get the question often, you know, how can you not close the schools? And I say back, how could you even think about closing the schools? And we're now seeing new research coming out of a study in Iceland also showing that there are also no particular good medical reasons for closing schools. So this is important, but it also affects gender equality. You close the school, parents have to come home, leave work. Many of them that do that then would be women. We know this from statistics. And on top of that, many of them are working in healthcare section and other types of care areas. So it has a series of ramifications. So I think the reasons for keeping schools open are very strong, and there is a high degree of support. In fact, I still have to meet anyone that I know among people I know who have kids who will seriously argue against open schools. So that's the one sort of concrete difference, I think, that's where Sweden stands out. The second one is the more general principle, which we also heard Tom talk about, namely that we have chosen, right, not a mandatory lockdown, right, sort of criminalizing certain types of behaviors, but rather we're resting it on an approach that's based on trust, on voluntary participation, on a shared responsibility, a notion of individual responsibility. That is to say, a policy based more on trust than on fear. Now, we can argue about that, of course, but when we look at data coming out now, we just look at sort of compliance data, looking at the degree of social distancing in Sweden and different countries. The differences are not particularly dramatic. So certainly it appears that this voluntary approach is in fact working. The big other argument here is about sustainability. Closing down society, social closure, is not sustainable in the long term. It's predicated really on a very, very short-term success in finding a vaccine or a cure. Should it last longer, right? The sustainability here, it becomes crucial. And I think this is another argument that's being made in Sweden, that we are sort of trying to look at it both from an individual societal perspective, both in what is sustainable in a short and in the longer term. These are sort of critical arguments. And those becoming more relevant now that we see a global discussion turning more towards how do you open up society. You have notions like whack them all, right? The idea you should open up and close again. Now that might be mathematically possible, but if you're looking at real social life, of course, it's not a very tenable solution. You can't sort of open the school 1 week, close it the next week, and reopen and so forth. The third point I want to make, right, is that there is a lot of recognition in Sweden, and there's a very important debate around the failures that we see here that are not actually so much related to the coronavirus crisis, but are hugely important. Namely, one, the failure to protect the elderly in institutions, and the second, the large proportion of those who are sick and dying that are in immigrant neighborhoods. Now, these speak to longer term issues, right, about, let's say, neoliberal reforms of the welfare sector in Sweden that's been going on for some time, failures when it comes to integration policies. These are going to be hugely important issues in the longer term, and that these constitute short-term failures within the context of the corona crisis, there's no question about, very important. But they are not merely or simply questions about the corona crisis policy. It's not clear that, that would have been much different had we gone for some form of lockdown. So those would be my opening points, because I know we are supposed to be relatively brief to begin with. Thank you.
Thank you, Lars. And the next speaker is Peter Baldwin. So Peter has, and the reason why he's on here is that he has worked on the history of health policies across different European countries, particularly Britain, France, Germany, and Sweden. He has also looked at the difference globally in how we addressed HIV/AIDS. And so we thought putting this in a historical perspective and also a wider perspective of how different countries deal with health scares or pandemics. So please, Peter, the floor is yours.
Thank you.
I should say, Peter, also that Peter is a professor at the UCLA and the New York University. Please, Peter.
Thank you, Eric. I hope I'm not going to add more grist to Lars's mill about Scandinavia being misrepresented in the greater world. But as the least Scandinavian person here on the panel, I may go in a slightly less consensual direction than some of the others, and I'd like to sort of firm up the distinctions a bit. Because effectively, the Swedish approach to coronavirus comes really entirely unexpected. I don't want to mince words. Sweden is a country that is very interventionist in every other respect. Drug addiction, alcohol use, prostitution, alles verboten, or at least very highly regulated. So the question is, why have the Swedes decided to go all liberalist precisely in the midst of the worst pandemic of a century? Well, the first problem is to determine what exactly the Swedish approach is. Now, it has to be said, it is not herd immunity. It is not deliberately letting people get affected so as to generate immunity. Everyone denies that. Instead, what the Swedes say is that it is doing what other nations are doing, but in a voluntary way that it does not require compulsion. Now, if that's true, then epidemiologically, there's actually no difference between the Swedish and other nations' tactics. Everyone is trying to flatten the curve to spread the cases out over a longer time. The difference is tactical. Maybe it's due to trust, maybe it makes more sense to call it obedience, but either way, it amounts to the same. The rules are followed one way or another, whether you do it through voluntary compliance or whether you do it through law enforcement. Sweden's refusal to impose a mandatory lockdown is not out of line with other nations. There are other nations that are following a similar course. But the company that Sweden is keeping is rather unusual. Its fellow Scandinavians, Denmark, Norway, Finland, are not following this course. But Iceland and the Netherlands are, South Korea has been. But the nations that are most vehemently against the lockdown also include the so-called ostrich alliance, the dictators with their heads in the sand, Nicaragua, Belarus, Turkmenistan, and above all, Bolsonaro's Brazil. These are among Sweden's peers in this approach, and of course, they're a rather motley bunch, to say the least. I know Tories in the UK who are amazed that their libertarian right-wing friends would ever have found occasion to hold Sweden up as a model, but now they are. So the question is, where does this unexpected approach come from? Swedish journalists have claimed that there's a kind of native tradition of voluntarist public health that's being followed. That sounds nice, but it seems to me it is simply not the case. Sweden is out of line with its own past. Historically, Sweden has clamped down firmly on contagious diseases. During the first cholera epidemics in the 1830s, Sweden imposed one of the most strict quarantine systems anywhere. For smallpox, Swedes mandated compulsory vaccination already early in the 19th century. For sexually transmitted diseases, the state was even more draconian. Not just sex workers, but all infected citizens were obliged to be treated. Anyone who refused to be treated, who refused to abstain from sex, could be jailed. This wasn't just some kind of outmoded approach from the dank reaches of the 19th century, because the same tactics were continued in the 1980s when the AIDS epidemic hit. So what I'm trying to say is that the new voluntarist approach to coronavirus is indeed a dramatic change of direction. And the question is, why do we have this U-turn? We all know that everybody is welcome to change their minds. Indeed, we encourage changing of minds, especially when the facts change. But have the facts changed? What is different about this disease to justify this sort of novel approach? Well, it seems to me it's easier to eliminate the reasons that do not explain the Swedish turnabout than it is to account for why it happened in the first place. It's clearly not the outcome of native traditions. And here's another reason why they cannot be the cause. The Swedish exception has nothing to do with politicians deferring to expertise. The Swedes often claim that they're leaving the important decisions to the experts and to science. But that is in effect what every political leader claims. The problem is that the experts don't speak with one voice. Politicians pick and choose among the conflicting recommendations that they're given. There are many Swedish experts who are against the current approach, but they're not the ones who are being listened to at the moment. The final point that I want to bring up is the question of whether or not the Swedish approach is working. If you look at the immediate outcomes, that is to say, if you look at the per capita death rates now, the answer is clearly no. For Sweden, they're almost three times higher than they are in Denmark. They're seven times higher than they are in Finland. Even worse, Sweden stands at place 10 on the global list of all nations ranked in this respect. If you look just at the death rates, you'd say that Sweden was doing something terribly wrong. Now, one reason for these Swedish rates and their highness is that the authorities have refused to acknowledge asymptomatic carriers as an issue. Silent carriers are a special problem when you take a voluntary approach. If you don't test, you can't find them. If you don't test, you don't know how many there are. And it doesn't matter how much social trust is out there in a society, the silent carriers still don't know that they're vectors. Now, it is true that we won't know the real outcome of these different approaches for many years. And it may be the case that in the long term, the outcomes of lockdown on the one hand and the outcomes of the Swedish approach may look quite different than they do right now. But of course, the long-term analysis cuts both ways too. Collateral damage attends also to lockdown. There are people who are harmed by being shut in. There are people who commit suicide because they're depressed. There are people who fail to get treatment for existing sicknesses. All these things are collateral damage in a lockdown scenario. But there's an upside as well to the lockdown strategy, which also has to be factored in. There are fewer violent crimes and murders. There are fewer traffic accidents. There are fewer workplace accidents. There's less pollution. There are fewer deaths attendant upon pollution. All of these things will have to be considered in the long run. But one hint that even this long-term calculation might not favor the Swedish approach comes from the tendency to avoid treatment for existing illnesses. In other nations, nations that are locking down, hospitalizations have decreased dramatically during the lockdown for heart attacks, strokes, for appendicitis, things like that. Now, obviously, people are not magically becoming healthier. So either we have a large number of excess deaths that are occurring outside of hospitals, or there is a future wave of non-corona-related mortality that we're somehow holding off during the lockdown, which is eventually going to break over us once it's over. Now, if the Swedes trusted their institutions, we would expect to see a difference here. Swedes would be going to the hospitals for non-corona-related issues in the same way that they continue to live their lives more normally in other respects. But apparently that's not the case. Those seeking treatment for heart attacks is down 25 to 50% since the start of the epidemic. So apparently Swedes don't trust their own hospitals either, any more than patients do in the lockdown nations. It seems to me, and with this I will end, it seems to me that there's a muddle at the heart of the Swedish approach. Anders Tegnell, who's the chief epidemiologist, was quoted 3 days ago saying the following: according to our modelers, we're starting to see so many immune people in the population in Stockholm that it's starting to have an effect on the spread of the infection. It's hard to say how he knows this. We're not yet even sure that having had the disease confers immunity. Antibody testing is still a mess. There are no reliable tests. And the Swedes haven't been doing mass testing, even if they could have. But the point here is that it sounds as though Tegnell is actually aiming at herd immunity, even though the Swedish authorities deny that that's what they're after. And here it seems to me is precisely the basic dilemma. You can have either voluntary measures, where citizens do on their own what in other countries they have to be ordered to do, or you can have herd immunity, but you can't have both at the same time. If you're getting herd immunity, then people are not voluntarily obeying the rules that they should be following. And I conclude, therefore, that we're left still with a mystery of why it is that the Swedes are pursuing this course.
On that note, thank you, Peter. Thank you for this very interesting historical and comparison, and also a very precise analysis of the current policy in Sweden. The next speaker is Sarah Herrmann. Sarah is a colleague of mine at LSE and Deputy Dean of the School of Public Policy. She has worked extensively on issues related to political processes and representation in the European Union, transparency in politics, and you're going to talk a bit about the politics of COVID-19 across Europe, but also in Scandinavia, I think.
Yes, I will. Thank you so much, Eric, and to all of you for this. I think it's fascinating to look into this fast evolving process that we are all living at the moment. I'll try and say first a few things about the great variation we see in the Nordic countries, and then broaden it out to what's happening at the EU level, because to my mind, we are seeing certainly a huge health issue, but as Lars pointed out earlier, it's also an issue that is hitting our societies and our the political landscape in Europe. Governments are going to fall over the actions they take during this crisis. Some might also see an increase in support, of course, but there will be great implications politically and economically for our societies as well. Now, the Swedish strategy has been puzzling for many, and it is interesting to compare it to its neighbours because of the great similarities. Of course, the Nordic countries are very homogenous in their welfare systems, in their healthcare systems, but nevertheless, I think it's very important when we make these comparisons that we keep in mind that there are some differences that are of defining nature in the response that is required with the coronavirus. Of course, the fact that we have very great variation in the population size, in geography and the demographics, and these require different considerations and interventions. But that still doesn't explain the differences in strategy by the governments. As we now see Sweden take new measures and getting into perhaps further restrictions. On the other hand, here in Copenhagen, where I'm based, at least for the moment, we are seeing schools open up this week after a much more restrictive set of interventions from the government, and the same has been the case in Finland and Norway as well. So Sweden does stand out in the Nordic picture in this respect, there may be implications of this, but apart from the differences that I just mentioned with regards to demographics, I think it's very important that we also highlight the rural and city implications. And there, it seems to me that the Swedish challenges are very much linked, of course, to how the response has been in Stockholm. In Copenhagen, or in Denmark rather, the concentration has also been in Copenhagen, but not to the same degree as we see it in Sweden. So we have had different considerations of the capital to the rural districts, which have not been the case in Sweden so far. Another issue is, of course, that we are at very different stages of the pandemic across the Nordic countries. Denmark was affected quite early on in the process, simply because a lot of people came back from northern Italy from ski holidays, where I think the Swedes may have stayed skiing in Sweden. And certainly that has been sort of a popular version of why we are where we are in Denmark, that we were hit so early on. The government's response was immediate and with very strong restrictions put into place, which were accepted and followed and supported by the public. There was a very good communication from the government regarding the medical advice that were given to them. And this was presented in a way that created confidence and support for the government's actions. I'd say that, and this goes for all countries who are living through this now, that of course, the immediate responses to the coronavirus are defining for the following process. But we are now witnessing in Denmark that this second phase, where we are starting to open up the country, is quite a different kind of process. And here, the government cannot refer to the expert advice on how to gradually introduce more and more social interaction, what strategy to put in place for opening up further educational places, etc. So here the government is almost left on its own with the strategy and how to develop the further process, and will have to take responsibility for that. And I'm very curious to see how that will go down with the public and with what consequences that will come out of this process, because I think the two phases that we have seen here in Denmark have been handled very differently and are potentially going to experience very different kinds of public support. It's a communication issue, but it's also an economic, social, and medical process to go through now. I think that if we look at this even broader than just the Nordic picture, it is clear that the economic consequences are very dire of this coronavirus. And will hit countries differently across Europe. Of course, with the countries being hit the worst and early on in the process, also seeing that they are now the ones struggling the most. And therefore, it is really a very important moment in the history of the EU. This week, we will see the meeting between the EU leaders on Thursday, tomorrow, which will in most likelihood define what kind of political and economic interventions are to happen from the EU level. And I'm convinced that this is a key moment for the further governance and for the further economic sustainability of the continent, in fact. There's huge disagreements between the countries in how to handle this. There are very different expectations from Italy, Spain, compared to some of the northern countries led by Germany. But I think that important steps are being taken, and there is a great deal of solidarity and real efforts being put into finding ways to address the coronavirus implications economically. I'm convinced that what comes out of this will have implications for the kind of collaboration and the kind of landscape we see in Europe going forward. Of course, a country like Sweden or Denmark, for that matter, sitting outside the Eurozone, is having to play a key role already from the very beginning in order to ensure that they will have influence in the longer term. So I think that it's important that we keep focused on the domestic.
I think so.
But also from the
now or than that
for the broader EU landscape. I will stop here, Eric. But I'm happy to elaborate later on.
So thank you very much, Sarah. And the last speaker on this panel is a Norwegian, the Ole Petter Ottersen, who is known to most Swedes as the rector of the Karolinska Institute, but he's a neuroscientist in the background, has worked a lot on global health, global governance issues. So Ole Petter, please, the floor is yours.
Let me first say that it's a privilege to be part of what you call, Eric, a Nordic or Scandinavian conspiracy. And it has been a privilege indeed for me as a Norwegian to compare the Norwegian and the Swedish strategy when it comes to this pandemic. And I guess that there are three issues that I would like to address. Most of my points have been taken by the other speakers, but three points remain. And I think that these three points are an adequate following up of what has been said thus far. The three keywords are humility, humbleness, when confronted with a treacherous enemy like the new coronavirus. That's number one. The whole picture when it comes to health. This is something that is missing from the debate today. I think Peter touched on the term collateral damage, and that is something that really belongs to this whole picture when it comes to health. And the third keyword that I think is so essential is that we as countries, we are becoming quite myopic in this debate. We are not looking across the borders. We are not taking into account the global dimension of this pandemic sufficiently. So these are the three issues that I would like to raise: humility, the whole picture, and the global dimension. It's interesting when we discuss the contrast between Norway and Sweden that, Norwegians very often are held to say that, we have the right recipe. The same thing goes for Sweden. But in fact, when we are looking now into what the public health authorities say about this issue, there is quite a lot of humility to statements. Just a few days ago, there was a debate on these differences between Norway and Sweden. And top representative, Frode Forland, of the Norwegian health authorities or public health agency said, and I quote, I'm translated this to English myself. It's hard to say, he says about the Norwegian approach, if this is a better strategy than the Swedish one in the long run. And I think this is exactly the humility that we have to apply to this discussion. We simply don't know which of these different strategies will be the best one. It will take years to find out which one is the best. And I think this has to be brought into the debate. We are in a situation where the debate must be colored by the uncertainty at hand. The virus simply doesn't come with a manual as to what measures should be taken to protect the society. It doesn't come with a manual as to how this disease should be diagnosed or treated in the best possible way. This calls for humility, and this is what I really